This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Like it or not, consumption drives this economy. So what one big consumer products company is selling tells us something. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, April 20th. Good to have you with us. That company I was talking about would be Procter & Gamble, maker of Tide and Pampers and Crest toothpaste and all sorts of other things. P&G said today its net sales grew 7% in the latest quarter, and the company's premium, aka more expensive products, did especially well in categories like healthcare, grooming, laundry, and baby care, suggesting that plenty of shoppers haven't been all that deterred by higher prices. At least not yet. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more.
This is not an easy consumer economy to navigate right now, with costs to produce and ship goods soaring and supply chains still messed up. So for Procter & Gamble to push sales and profits way up was a pretty big feat, says Erin Lash at Morningstar.
The firm was able to raise prices, a 5% increase in prices, while also growing volumes. So there wasn't that trade down or pushback at the consumer level.
Meaning consumers didn't look at the high price of Bounty or Tide, then look in their wallet and decide to buy cheaper paper towels or detergent. But this doesn't mean consumers will fork over any amount anywhere, says Arun Sundaram at CFRA Research.
We've seen consumers become more conscious about where they shop. Rather than buying that Bounty paper towel at your local grocery store, heading to a discount store or a club store to buy a larger pack size, their cash outlay is greater, but they're getting better value for their buck.
Why are we sticking with the more expensive brands? Well, for one thing, we're still spending pandemic style, says Chris Jackson at polling firm Ipsos, not going out so much, pampering ourselves.
People are spending more time at home. Maybe you want to spend more on good quality home stuff.
But this is only true of some consumers, says Kayla Brune at public opinion firm Morning Consult.
The consumers driving a lot of the demand for discretionary purchases do tend to be the ones earning a higher income.
Among households earning less than $50,000 a year, more folks are struggling with inflation, says Chris Jackson. They could still be trying to catch up on debts after job and income loss in the pandemic.
That low-income group has recovered a little bit, but it's been much slower, much more fitful. And it's that low-income group that's really the most squeezed by cost increases.
And they're the consumers most likely to trade down to cheaper products or just buy less. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, mixed bag, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Speaking of inflation, higher prices along with higher mortgage rates do appear to be slowing demand in the housing market. The National Association of Realtors says sales of existing homes fell last month for the second month in a row. The number of homes for sale was up almost 12% in March from the month before, but not enough to stop prices from going up too. The median sale price was more than $375,000. As you probably heard us talk about on this program, more of the demand for single-family houses these days is coming from investors, buying homes not to live in or flip, but to rent to someone else. Now, some homeowners associations, or HOAs, are trying to stop them. Nicole Friedman co-wrote a piece about it this week at the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So I think a lot of people hear homeowner association and they think, you know, groups that enforce rules about like holiday decorations and lawn maintenance, but they have a lot more power than that. How are they using it to try to restrict investors?
Yes, they do have pretty broad legal authority to control, you know, how people use their homes within the association. Homeowner associations are in some cases changing their covenants to restrict investor purchases. In some cases, they're saying only a certain percentage or certain number of homes in a neighborhood can be rented at a given time. Or in other cases, they're saying that a home has to be occupied by an owner for 6 months or a year or 2 years before it can be rented, which would then deter investors who want to buy homes in that neighborhood.
There is a lot to unpack there, but I want to dig in first to the argument about investors driving up home prices. I mean, do we have a lot of evidence that investor sales are making it harder for, you know, regular folks to buy homes?
So this is a hot topic in the housing market right now. Yeah. A lot of homes on the market are getting multiple offers. And in some cases, some of those offers are coming from investors. And for a seller, a cash offer is often preferable to an offer with a mortgage. But not all cash buyers are investors. Not all investors are cash buyers. Certainly, investors do make up a portion of the demand. The latest estimates we've seen from CoreLogic are about 1 in 5 homes is being purchased by an investor. But that still means 80% of homes are being purchased, you know, by owner occupiers. And so some of that demand, that competition isn't necessarily exclusively due to investors, but they do play a role in making the market more competitive.
And of course, investor can mean a lot of different things, right? It can mean a corporation or a private equity firm, but it can also mean, you know, the sort of classic mom and pop landlord.
Absolutely. And a lot of investors are, you know, individuals or people that own, you know, a handful of homes.
Is there a risk here of discriminating, though, against renters who are also facing limited housing options, rising rents, and, you know, need places to live?
That's definitely a concern. There is a shortage of housing in the for sale market and a shortage in the rental market. But the homeowners that I speak to, you know, they say in some cases that the rents being charged in their neighborhood are just as much or more than a mortgage. And they say that by taking these homes off the market and turning them into rentals, that it makes it more difficult for people who want to become homeowners to find homes that they can buy.
Well, while I've got you on the line, I've got to ask you about today's housing news, which showed that existing home sales fell again last month. And there's signs that, you know, higher mortgage rates are having an impact on the market. I wonder if we're going to see any relief for people who are looking to buy a home if the demand slows down.
Yeah, it's a big question. And from talking to realtors and buyers around the country, it does sound like there are people dropping out of the market. But what I hear is that the demand just is so far ahead of the supply that even with people dropping out of the market, there's still way more demand. And the latest figures today from the National Association of Realtors showed that the proportion of cash buyers is rising. It was 28% of existing home sales in March were purchased in cash. And a year ago, that was 23%.
Wow. All right. Well, Nicole Friedman, good to have you on. She covers housing at the Wall Street Journal and wrote about the effort by HOAs to crack down on investor sales. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Earlier this week, we had an update on that $1.2 trillion infrastructure package Congress passed last fall. The Biden administration is requiring projects funded by that money to use U.S.-made materials. The president's on a bit of an infrastructure tour this week, promoting the expected improvements to ports and bridges and broadband in places like Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and Portland, Oregon. That inflation we've been talking about, though, could throw a wrench into some of these projects, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains.
You think you've noticed prices going up lately? Talk to Michael Cicada.
You know, we have seen 400% increases in even more on some degree on some of these structural steel materials.
Cicada heads the Maryland Transportation Builders and Materials Association. According to a new report from S&P Global, the producer price index for building materials and supplies increased more than 58% from January of 2020 to March of this year. S&P's Kurt Forsgren is a co-author of the report. He says there is one bright spot. The biggest projects that'll get bipartisan infrastructure law funding haven't gotten off the ground yet. The hope is inflation will be lower by the time they get underway.
The primary question is how long will it, is it expected to last? And I think everyone's hope is that it doesn't last too long. And this small blip in the road will just be that, no pun intended.
But even if prices do fall, infrastructure projects face other hurdles. Supply chain snarls, of course, but also a shortage of workers. All these challenges could force state and local governments to make some tough choices. Leah Brooks, an economist at George Washington University, says they might put the biggest projects, those that need the most workers and materials, on the back burner.
There's an incentive to choose projects that you think will you'll be able to complete more quickly, and that's probably projects that are less risky or less ambitious.
Things like paving roads and repairing potholes. And if costs don't go down, state and local governments could borrow, apply for more federal money, or raise taxes and fees to pay for those big projects. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up,
hundreds of orders.
Well, that's good. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 249.7% to finish at 35,160. The Nasdaq fell 166 points, 1.2% there, to end at 13,453. And the S&P 500 dipped 2 points, essentially flat, to land at 44.59. Mitchell Hartman looked at why consumers are buying some expensive brands despite inflation on word that Procter & Gamble sales were up. So strolling on over to the laundry detergent and diaper aisles, P&G lathered up 2.6%. British consumer goods multinational Unilever rose 1.4%. Netflix said it lost about 200,000 subscribers in the first 3 months of this year. So investors quickly unplugged too. Netflix plunged more than 35%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. The Biden administration took another step this week to address the more than $1.7 trillion in outstanding student loan debt. Yesterday, the Department of Education announced changes that will cancel the debt for 40,000 borrowers and bring another 3.6 million Americans much closer to loan forgiveness. This comes after the administration again extended a pause on student loan payments until August. Many activists would like to see the federal government go much further. Hannah Appel is an associate professor of anthropology at UCLA and co-director of the Debt Collective, a group born out of the Occupy movement pushing for widespread debt cancellation. Dr. Appel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much. It's wonderful to be here.
Why the big push to forgive student loan debt in particular, not other kinds of debt?
Absolutely. Actually, at the Debt Collective and the provocation of a debtors union more generally, we are organized around all kinds of household debt. We believe that in concert with the labor movement, right, debtors, like workers, can actually exercise far more democratic control over how these things are financed. And part of what does distinguish student debt from those other kinds of debt is that it's held 95%+ by the federal government, which is to say, the creditor, the regulator, the collector are all one and the same. And it happens to be a body that is, in theory, democratically responsive to us, right? In a way that a bank, for example, isn't yet. And so I think we've seen the most progress and we've been able to build the most power around student debt because it plainly is a policy failure for which we can hold the government accountable and they can reverse course.
What kind of difference could this make for people who hold student debt, which, you know, who are disproportionately lower income people and people of color?
Absolutely. One thing that's so important to notice about student debt, most people that hold it, 90%+, right, through the federal government, have an interest rate above 7%. Student debt has remained at or above 7%, and it's compounding interest, which is to say people who have paid hundreds of dollars, sometimes thousands of dollars, month after month after month for years, have only watched their balances grow, right? When we disaggregate student debt by race and ethnic identity, we see that it is Black women in particular who disproportionately hold student debt burdens. Canceling student debt, which Biden can do without congressional approval, is the quickest way to narrow the racial wealth gap. And as Ayanna Pressley said, if you want to thank Black women, cancel student debt.
I got to ask you about the economic cost, though. I mean, that you mentioned the trillions of dollars in student loan debt outstanding. What does that mean for the federal budget and the deficit?
Yes. Yeah, it's an excellent question. Millions of people, long before the pandemic, have already been in default on their loans, which is to say not paying them. In fact, 1 million new student debtors, long before the pandemic payment pause, would be in default on their loans. The cost-benefit analyses internal to the Department of Education that they've already done, they have already acknowledged internally, long before the pandemic, that they were never going to collect on the vast majority of student loans. They are simply uncollectible. So it's a mistake to think that this is, you know, for example, some of the counter arguments we hear, oh, this is going to be a burden on taxpayers. On the contrary, taxes will not go up if this debt is canceled. But in fact, money back in to those 45 million taxpayers who are also student debtors' pockets at a time, of course, when inflation is skyrocketing, people can't afford gas and could really use some additional money in their pockets.
But I do want to ask you one more question, which I hear a lot when the conversation comes up. People like you and I, who I just recently finished paying off my own student loan debt.
Congratulations.
From grad school. Yes, thank you. You know, I think a lot of people, either they don't have student loan debt or they have paid it off. And so they think, why should we give these young people a break? Or not all young people, I should say. When I did my share. What's your answer to that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, the first thing I would say is there are 45 million people who still owe significant balances, right? class inequality, race inequality, the intersection of race and class inequality in this country and certainly far beyond are one of the most pressing problems that we all have to deal with. This isn't just about student debt, right? This is about what kinds of futures do we want for ourselves? What kinds of futures do we want for our neighbors? The extraordinary debts, $30,000, $40,000, 7% interest, compounding interest that my students are leaving with today is unmatched to what folks a generation ago had to face. Again, it's a very recent policy failure, and it's one that can be reversed.
All right. Hannah Appel is co-director of the Debt Collective and also an assistant professor of anthropology at UCLA. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. It was great to be with you.
Parents who received advance payments of the expanded child tax credit last year should see the remaining half of that credit in their refunds this year. But the expansion was temporary, part of the Biden administration's American Rescue Plan. A push by Democrats to make that permanent isn't going anywhere in Congress, despite growing evidence that the expanded credit has made a big difference for families. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
It might feel like you've heard this story before. I've certainly done it before. There's been a bunch of research on the child tax credit.
In many ways, the findings were not surprising.
Elaine Mogg worked on a study that just came out from the Tax Policy Center. She says there are some new findings.
We noticed that people were less likely to be relying on credit cards, payday loans, or pawn shops to make ends meet during the time when they were getting the child tax credit.
But for the most part, this latest study confirmed a lot of things we already knew and that we've heard over and over again from parents.
So half of it went right into the account that we pay bills and stuff for.
Stephanie Lane and her husband live near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, with their three youngest kids, who are 10, 6, and 3.
The other half went to us allowing the kids to do some type of activity that we normally wouldn't have the money for them to do.
Like karate lessons. They were getting $800 a month from the credit.
Oh, it was huge for us.
Study after study from the Census Bureau, from Columbia's Center on Poverty and Social Policy, and in the Journal of the American Medical Association has found most parents spent the credit on healthier food, education, extracurriculars, and household necessities. Alyssa Schmier is with the advocacy group Moms Rising.
It's incredibly frustrating, I think, to have a tool at our disposal that cuts child poverty almost in half, that really helps low and moderate income families in a way that we haven't really seen in a long time. And we just can't break through to make it a permanent long-term program.
Despite the growing body of evidence that all says it works. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
The Federal Reserve published its Beige Book today, a highlight for economy watchers. It's a collection of economic anecdotes gathered by the regional Fed banks from their contacts around the country. It comes out 8 times a year. And one theme this time around, which will sound familiar from the top of the show, is that despite prices going up across the board, people in nearly every region continued shopping. And that leads me to one of our retail regulars. Annie Lang Hartman runs Compass Paper Company, a stationery business in Leland, Michigan. And she sent us this dispatch.
We've been pretty busy over the last few weeks. We have carted hundreds of orders over to our small local post office. Our greeting cards are still our biggest sellers. There's hardly ever an order that goes out our door that doesn't have at least one greeting card in there. As far as price changes, we haven't had to raise any of our prices at the moment. We have some manufacturers that have added a temporary surcharge to things. And at the moment, we're just eating that in the hopes that it really, truly is a temporary price increase. I think that's wildly optimistic, but for the moment, we have not had to raise prices on anything. We are currently working on relaunching our business on May 2nd. So we're doing a big rebranding. And because of that, we are trying to flip our entire inventory. At the end of the holiday season, we were out of so many products that we just decided it was a great time to really just let things sell out. And when it's time to reorder, we reorder with our new name. As far as other things to do for this rebrand, it's kind of endless. You know, new website, new packaging, things like flipping your entire social media over to new handles and worrying that your SEO is going to drop off when you switch your domain name. That's a big deal. I think we're definitely going to have a little dip in online sales, but I think it's definitely going to be worth it.
Here's hoping. Annie Lang Hartman, running for now Compass Paper Company. This final note on the way out today, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen walked out of today's G20 meeting in Washington as Russian delegates spoke. She was joined by top officials from the U.K. and Canada, as well as representatives from Ukraine who were at the meeting of world powers. One source told Reuters that Secretary Yellen said there could be no business as usual for Russia in the global economy. The Treasury Department also unveiled new sanctions today against a Russian commercial bank, a Russian oligarch, and companies involved in virtual currency mining. Here's your moment of economic context and a little more housing news from the aforementioned Beige Book. Several regions reported accelerated multifamily housing construction. This after yesterday's news from the census of strong apartment construction last month. Good news for renters, but the report goes on, rents are still high around the country. And the New York Fed quoted an expert saying that bidding wars in the city are occurring on about 1 in 5 new leases. Yikes. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.